So we are way behind because I chat, and as I look through the notes for the next section, we pretty much talked about everything in it. So I'm going to just kind of highlight stuff, and I've done a ton of. One of the things about conferences like this is I'm doing 20 talks or so, so I read through all the notes again to kind of catch myself up. But then, because I've read all the notes already, stuff's rattling around in my head that I'm going to say but aren't in this lecture, and so I keep saying things that are coming later because they were the most recent things I read. So it's a little bit crazy. So a lot of stuff that we're going to say in this talk I've already said. So let me talk a little bit about the homework thing. If you didn't get copies of the homework sheets that we use or used to use, I think Marilyn might still use. Do you still use these? For homework? Do you use these homework sheets for homework? No, you just tell them stuff? Okay. So I don't actually use these anymore because I figured out how to put it on my iPad. And I can print it right out on my iPad there. So what I have is the homework sheet on one side and then a half a page to pick notes on the other side. And what I do is throughout the course of the session is, the way that I use these, and I'm actually might be saying now what I'm gonna say in an hour or so. But you give homework, and then the next session, you go through the homework and ask them about what they did. So if you gave them homework to read their Bibles and mark things that jump out at them, things they have questions about, things they really like, things they don't like at all, the next session, you sit down and you say, okay, so tell me where you read. And then you say, what did you mark? And you go, you get your Bible out, and they have their Bible, you go through it with them and say, why did you mark that? And now you talk about that and how it applies and what's going on in their life. Or if you're going through a book, you say, let's talk about your homework. And they went through the second chapter in Strengthening Your Marriage. Or I have questions, study questions for Doug's Reforming Marriage. If you want those, send me a note. And I can send those to you. And so we just go through the questions and the answers and things that especially jumped out at them, things that just, if they just, I don't go through them and answer them with them right then. I just say, what answers or what questions caused you trouble? And then we talk about those. And then we spear off and run around the room talking about issues that come up because of this homework that they did. So I'll say, did you go on a date? What did you do? And sometimes that's just, back when my wife was around, I used their examples of dates for stuff for us to do. What fun thing did you do? Well, we went and looked at the observatory. Well, there's an observatory? Yeah, it's right up there on the hill. Oh, great. And I write it down so I can go look at the observatory. That's how I use homework. And then you'll see this afternoon that's how Randy uses the homework. And that's a good way to work through all those eight things that they had to talk about. Is it comes out in the homework, through the homework. And it's because the session that you're in is not the session where God gets with the people. God gets with the people when they're at home doing their homework. All you're doing is pointing, okay? So I guess I could show you. You can't really see it from there anyway, but I guess I could show it later when we use the whiteboard. But I have the homework assignment on one side, and then I have comments and questions and things I want to talk about on the right-hand side. And then when it's time to go, I have a printer right there. I just take my thing and circle all my notes and delete them, and then print out the homework assignment and then paste back in my notes. So they don't have my notes. They just have the homework assignment. I just print it out like that. This one, you have two copies, but you always have to have a paper copy somewhere. And I just thought this is safer to put it on here and then somewhere in my computer that's more coded than in my file cabinet, because people can come and look it through your file cabinet. Yeah. Yeah, so we'll talk about a lot of that stuff. And in fact, let me check. I wrote Made myself a note. I'm checking to see if it's in this one. No, I think it's later today. We talk about, sometimes people will say, just let it go. You got to let it go. Or give up on it or something along those lines. And again, I'll say this again later. But we don't let things go. We give them to God. And it's very similar to when you take your, this isn't going to apply if you change your own oil. Does anybody here change their own oil? So you don't have to listen. It won't. But there's probably something in your life where you do this with. The rest of us who don't change our own oil, we take our car to the oil place, the car place, and we give them, we say, can you change my oil today? And they say, oh, sure, can you leave your car? And you say, oh, sure, and you give them your key, and you fill out your name, and you give them your phone number, and you go away, and you do your thing, and when they call you up, you go back and get your car, or later in the day. But in between the time when you give them your key and give them your phone number and you go away, you most of us don't ever think about it again until they call us. And then we go, oh, yeah, my car's over at the car place. I gave them my car to take care of it. So what's going on there? Well, you have these experts that say they fix cars. They'll work on your car. And you trust them, and so you give them your car to fix. You don't call them up and say, hey, did you get the right nut there for the oil pan thing to get the oil out? Did you make sure you turned the right one and not the wrong one? And they go, yeah, we got the right one. Did you use the right torque wrench on the thing to get to put it back on so it doesn't strip those threads on the thing? Yeah, I got the right one. Did you use the right, call them back a few minutes later, did you use the right oil? I don't think you got the right oil. I just checking to make sure you did it right. We don't do that. We just give it to them and let it go. Give it to them, let them have it. And then they give it back later. Well, I think that's how it is with God. We take the event that's so big in our life, and we give it to God, and we say, you have it. It's all yours. And we don't go back every 10 minutes and say, you still got that? You still taking care of that? Do you still have that? We give it to him. We know he can handle it. He says things like this. In Romans 12, Paul says, love your enemies, give them to God. God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Most of the time, the reason we can't give things to God and let him have them are because the person's going to get away with it. They beat me up when I was 3. They beat me up for years and years and years. We think they're going to get away with it if we give it away to God. But God says, no, 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 that's not how it works. Vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. And we need to believe him like we do when we give our car. I think that's a really good analogy, I think, to how we handle difficult things in our lives. Is we don't let it go, because if we just let it go, it would get away with it. It would be like it didn't happen. But it did happen, and it was bad, and it happened to me, and you don't get it. Well, I do get it, but God gets it way more than I get it. So give it to him. And every time it pops into your head, you don't go, hey, did you use the right oil? You say, God, you have it. And he says, yes, I have it. It's okay. I've got it. Does that make sense? And part of it is a habit. We've gotten into the habit of dredging it up and thinking about it and mulling it over and looking at it, take it out, look at it. It's really, really bad. Well, we're just creating new habits. The new habit is give it to him, give it to him, give it to him. Leave it with him. And pretty soon we stop thinking about it altogether, especially if we add to the fact that us dredging it up and thinking about it again is what bitterness is about, and that's sin. We don't get to do that. So we have, and then also another thing in all of this is that the God of glory wants us to be in fellowship with him and us to mull over the things that have happened to us in a bad way and be angry and bitter and resentful about them is marring our relationship with him. And he doesn't like that, but he wants us in relationship with him. So he wants us to give it to him. So he empowers us to give it to him. So it's not just, if we were all just non-Christians talking about philosophy, talking about giving things away or taking things away, it would just all be in the power of us to do it, but it's not. It's the power of God gets in our lives and changes our, and transforms us and changes our habits. So when bad things have happened, we give them to him and let him deal with them, just like our oil change. Now, the oil change is not nearly as high a level of, if we had a $800,000 car and gave it to the oil change guy, we probably would go to a different oil change guy. But still, we'd leave it there with him and say, I trust you. Okay, is that okay? We're good? Again, we'll probably talk about that again. Oh, I have an announcement. This is going to wreak havoc on our recording all over the place. But that's okay. Sean is really good at that kind of stuff. I would just handed a note in between the sessions that Doug Wilson's talk on Thursday will now be on Wednesday instead of on Thursday.
Which one is it?
At 4 o'clock. So right now he's on, you have schedules, he's on Thursday? Right, so now he's on Wednesday at 4 o'clock. So we'll just flip-flop him in the video. Okay, so Galatians 6:1 says, "Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted." So this is talking about God. How do we talk about God? And I think there's a variety of ways to do it. One of them is just flat out do it. Just talk about God. And I think that's, most of the time, that's the way to go, if depending on your context. If you're talking about all of this kind of stuff in an office situation and the person you're talking to is clearly not a Christian, or maybe even is anti-Christian and said things about those nasty Christians, you want to talk about God in a slightly different way, I think. Or you could just brazen through it and just push through and just talk about God like everything's fine. And depending on how things go, that might be the best way to go. I remember in the Navy, guys talked like they were in the Navy. I don't know if you've ever talked to a sailor. But on submarines, they're, at least from what I know about it, submariners are notoriously gross, more gross than the average sailor. And so these guys just have really filthy, foul mouths, and they would, you know, just every other word. It's like, how do you even say anything? Because all the cuss words in there. Well, one time we were talking to somebody, and Doug came up while somebody was talking, Doug Wilson, and he says, "You kissed your mother with that mouth?" And I looked at him like, "What? What are you talking about?" "So that filthy mouth you have there, you kissed your mother with that mouth?" And they looked at him like he'd hit them. And they're just all confused, didn't know what to say. And then they kind of went on. But it was just a way to check what was going on and change the context. And everybody, it was something different about him. What's he doing over there? And then one time he said, "Why do you use all those words that don't actually mean anything in your sentence? Why don't you use the word doorknob? It doesn't mean anything either, but it isn't offensive." You could just stick a doorknob in there, the doorknob microphone, the doorknob glasses, the doorknob podium. You wouldn't offend anybody, and it doesn't mean anything either. You're not meaning what you're saying. So sometimes he did it that way, and he just changes the context and the what's going on. So you would do that in a setting that wasn't necessarily a counseling setting. In a normal counseling setting, especially in a biblical counseling setting, you can just talk about God like that's how it is. In fact, that's I think the best way to do it. You just start talking about God as the normal conversation you would have with anybody. If somebody was on fire for Jesus and they came in, and you just talk about God like it's happening, and it's all right here. Talk that way with everybody, even if people don't believe in him. And so that girl I mentioned a while ago that I flirted with, I just talked that way about her. I just assumed he existed and cared for her and loved her and wanted her to do good things and have a joyful life, and that's how I talked to her. And I did it in an excited kind of let's go together kind of way, and that's she got caught up in it, and by the end of the session, she was all excited about Jesus and ran off wanting to, it was great. So that's one way to do it. We mentioned before that you need to be spiritual, and what that means, that you're walking with God, you're not, you don't have anything going on with you that keeps you from wanting to help this person. You're remembering in the whole process that helping this person means bringing them to Jesus and letting Jesus get in their life and mess up with their hair. We mentioned the other day, this is one of Doug's things, is you can't see the back of your own head. So what we're doing in the counseling process is helping people see the back of their head. And sometimes you need to mention this a lot, because sometimes they can't see what they can't see, and they can't see what you see, and sometimes they don't believe that you see what you see. And that's the seven questions thing, is to help them see what you see without you being the one who tells them. You're letting them discover it. So you keep in mind the whole process that you don't have a dog in the fight. It's not about you, it's about them. It's not about them, it's about God and them. And you just always want to keep that there. You're not the savior. You're not their savior. You're not the one changing them. And this has tremendous value for your own sanity. Sanity is the right word. But if you, let's say you're, I checked on my calendar last week. I had 20 sessions last week, counseling sessions last week. And I've had as high as 27. I think that's the most that I counted at one time. But let's say you have 5 or 6 in a day. And they're all horrendous, awful things, you know, just explosions everywhere. Things are falling all apart. How do you live with that? Well, I live with that by reminding myself that this isn't about me. I'm there to help them be wonderful and glorious and joy-filled. I'm not there to wallow in their suffering with them or even to allow them to wallow in their suffering. I want them to be lifted up to Jesus, and so that's what I do in the process. So overwhelmingly, my goal is like the girl. She comes in grumpy, she goes out zippy, happy, joyful. When all the people come in counseling, they're all having a hard time. When they leave, I want them to be filled with hope and glory and joy and running off to run meet with Jesus. So at the end of my day, I'm not all grumpy and sad and blah because the people I talk to aren't grumpy and blah and sad. Now, every once in a while, just the sheer emotion of the whole thing is exhausting to me. And so what I'll do is I'll drive around town before I go home. Now, when I was married, it was different because I didn't want to take this grump home with me. I didn't want to walk in the front door and Eileen look at me and say, oh, you've had a hard day. I wanted to go home for her. I didn't want to go home with me. So this is maybe a guy thing a little bit, but I think it'd be handy for all of us, is you have your hat, you have your counselor hat on, and you do your counseling, and then when it's time to go home, you take your counselor hat off, and you set it down, and you put your I'm at home now hat on. And I'm not there for those people when I'm at home. I'm here for these people when I'm at home. And so sometimes if it was an emotionally draining day, I would drive around town before I went home to make sure that this hat was off and this hat was on. So when I walk through the door, it's, everybody's here, it's a party. And I think that's helpful, it's really helpful. Another way to help that is I noticed over time that if I had, let's say I had a whole bunch of premarital counseling in a row or to do. If I had, let's say, 4 premarital counseling, and premarital counseling is the best because they are just, people who are in love are just so excited. You might as well not even be in the room. You're sitting there and they're sitting in the same chair together. or the chairs are so close together that they're all smooshed up together and they're looking at each other and they're like stuck to the ceiling and you have to drag them down to talk to them. But you have 3 or 4, let's say you have 3 or 4 of those in a row, and somehow they manage to get in a row. And so by the time you're done, you're just as excited about life as they are. Well, you get one grumpy one at the end of the day, let's say. One really hard one, really hard. That will mess you up for the whole rest of the evening if you let it. But I also noticed that if you get 4 or 5 grumpy ones and you get one of those pre-marriage ones at the end, you'll go home zippy and happy. So if you can arrange your schedule to have the last one be a fun one, then your evening will be fun just all by itself. But if you can't do it that way, I think it's really important to remember that you're not the center of the, it's not your party. You are there to help them walk with God, and your job in the moment is to help them feel hope and joy and love in the process. So like you notice with Trey and Deb, when he's talking at the end of this thing, they're looking at each other, and you're thinking, are they going to smile at each other? But you could tell that they felt positive about the whole experience, right? You could tell that they were excited to go home and do their homework and come back the next week because he filled them up. So at the end of the session, he wasn't feeling grumpy at all. He was feeling like, hey, look at us go. And so were they. So I think that's part of this whole, the concept of talking about God and leaving it there with him. So we would do that. People who are suffering do that, but so do we as counselors do that. We give the people that we're counseling to God. So I say, and I'm praying with them, I say, God, you take these people and you draw them to yourself and make them into Jesus' likeness. And then I'm done. I'm not part of it anymore. Now, sometimes they call me on the phone later, and sometimes they send me emails and texts and stuff, and I respond to them. But in terms of me being tied up in their troubles. I'm not tied up in their troubles because it's Jesus' troubles. It's not my trouble. And it's important to keep that all in mind as you're talking with people. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, another important thing to remember in all of this is the gospel is key. 1 Corinthians 15:3 gives a really succinct, distinct definition or description of what the gospel is. Jesus died on the cross for our sins. He rose from the dead. A whole bunch of us saw it. And it needs to be central in all of your counseling. The gospel is the main thing. Keep it there. Another thing about that is it's all of grace. It's all free. You're not earning anything. All you're doing essentially is helping your people believe it. Now, if you come from a church, and the church I grew up in, the gospel was preached every single Sunday. Every Sunday an invitation was given. Every Sunday people raised their hand or stood up or whatever the response to the gospel was. But there wasn't much application of the gospel in life. And so for years and years and years, I didn't know what that meant. When it said the gospel is key to life, I didn't know what that meant because the gospel, as far as I knew, was you get saved and you go to heaven when you die. But the gospel in your life, grace in your life, power in your life, joy in your life, the fruit of the Spirit in your life is huge when you start thinking about it. And so what we're trying to do largely, overwhelmingly, is let people read the scriptures and believe it. Does God take your trouble? When you give it to him, does he take it? Does he care about it? Does he do anything with it? And he does. We need to believe that. So there's a ton of things in the counseling process that a ton of things where you're simply saying, do you believe that that's true? You need to believe that. So a lot of times the homework is read it and believe it, read it and believe it, read it and believe it, and then act on it. If I believe it's true, I'll act in a certain way. If I believe the guy that's going to change my oil is going to change my oil, then I leave it and I don't call him up every 10 minutes and ask him about it. The same thing happens with God. Now, every once in a while, someone will notice that the person that they gave to God because he was so mean to them gets saved. They get away with it. But they don't get away with it because Jesus was killed for it. Right? And that's how the gospel applies in this case. Do you believe that Jesus was killed for your sin? Do you believe that Jesus was killed for their sin? Well, I believe he was killed for mine, but I don't want him killed for theirs. That would be bad. But that just shows we don't get the gospel, right? Jesus said, if you don't forgive your brother their sin, God won't forgive you your sin. And that's all tied together in this thing, that Jesus died to take the punishment for people's sin. They didn't get it. No one got away with it. God punished Jesus for it. So that's all tied in together with our counseling. We need to believe the gospel, believe that Jesus did this. It's all about love, it's all about grace, it's all about mercy, it's all about blessing, it's all about faith. Do you believe it's true? If you believe it's true, you act that way. Now, an illustration that I use about this, and again, I think I'm jumping the gun, but all the chairs you're sitting in. So you all know Chaba? Chaba Leidenfrost, he's up here in the front. If Chaba had been the first person, I should use Bob because he was the first person in the room. So I'll use Bob, he's back there with the hat. Bob came in the room, and he sat on the chair, and the chair exploded into 1,000 pieces, and he found himself sitting on the floor with pieces of chair all around him, his hat's all crazy, his glasses all nuts. And he came in, and you go, what happened, Bob? And he says, I don't know, I sat on the chair, and it collapsed on me and exploded in all these pieces. How chipperly, how enthusiastically would you all have sat in your chairs? Probably not so much, right? You'd probably be checking them. His chair exploded, my chair might explode, right? But the reason that you sat in your chairs the way that you did, none of you probably checked your chairs today because nothing happened to Bob. Bob was good. You just plopped down in your chair because the chairs have been faithful so far. Tomorrow, you'll probably just plop down in them again. Plunk, plop. Because the chairs are faithful. Faith in God is trust in a faithful God. We trust God because he's faithful. We trust our chairs because they're faithful. If they exploded and fell all to pieces, we wouldn't trust them anymore. So the next time, Bob came in today, his chair exploded. Tomorrow, the chairs all put back together, and he's going to check his chair. He's going to check it, and it's solid, so he sits in it carefully, slowly. We all come in, we saw his exploded chair, so now we're all checking our chairs too. The rest of us check our chairs. Over time, as the chair remains faithful, we will start to slowly get more and more like we just sit in them again, like we did today. So over time, the trustfulness of the chair is rebuilding the trust, and we're trusting it and relying on it and sitting in it. And I think that's how we are with God. We do need to test and see that the Lord is good. Taste and see that the Lord is good. But we also sort of test to see that he's good. Our faith, and that's what faith growing is we realize that God is faithful like the chair, and he's going to hold us up, and he's going to fulfill his promises, and he's going to do what he says. But we have to, but and here's the other side of that, is we have to want to. We have to let him. If we came in the room and all of us decided we weren't going to ever sit in those chairs again, we all just are going to stand in the aisles or next to the chairs, then we aren't allowing the chair to trust, to rebuild its trust in us. So a lot of counseling is helping us both be trustworthy and letting the person become trustworthy. And that's part of the counseling process too. But ultimately, it isn't really, it's like a husband and a wife. He's done mean things, I can't trust him. She's been done mean things, I can't trust her. But ultimately, it's really about trusting God. Because God says, love your wife. God says, submit to your husband. So we aren't submitting or loving because we just think that's a cool idea. We're doing it because we trust the God who told us to do it. And so our counseling is still focusing on God, trusting God. I can trust my husband because I'm trusting God. Now, my husband might still be a schmo, but it's not about him, it's about God. And as we trust in God more and more, our love, our respect, our treatment of the other person in our relationship will cause them to transform in the process, and God's also in it with them too. So the counseling process helps all of this thing together. Yes? Yeah, I think the key is you walking with God, them seeing an example of it. And it doesn't mean you're perfect, and we talked about that in the qualifications part. You're not perfect, you're still human. I'm still human. And like you said, Randy's a very different person than me. And that factors into the counseling thing too, which is why we need more counselors, is because I can meet with somebody and think, well, this isn't going to go well. We need so-and-so over here who's much better at this kind of what it looks like here than what I am. And there's times when I'll have another counselor sit in on the first session and give the person to them because that it's going to be a better fit. So there is fit things in there too. But generally speaking, the key is getting me out of the picture and getting God into the picture in a way that the person, the counselor, counselee person, can trust him. And I don't want to always be focused on me. I don't want to, I probably use way too many examples from my counseling system, counseling experience, but I'd rather use other people's experiences walking with God than my experiences walking with God, just because I want to get me out of the thing. I don't want them, I do, as Paul says, imitate me as I imitate Christ, but I think that's a natural thing. I don't need to tell people that. But I do. I am in a position as a counselor and as a pastor and an elder and all that kind of stuff to be in that spot, to be in that spotlight. And you would be, all of y'all would be, if you're trying to help people. But I don't think you need to toot your horn, that kind of thing. So I don't know if I did. I answer your question. But the main thing is be godly, be yourself, and be godly. I could counsel like Randy does. I could look, you know, all stern and whatever. Stern isn't the right word, but. More serious, I guess, but it wouldn't be me. Say that again?
There needs to be something, there's got to be, well, I'm assuming there's something between what you do, what Rand does, and you know, you brought up Jim, and there's something that's communicated with the person that goes beyond personality.
Yeah, I love them. That's my tone, my attitude going in. And I express to them that there's hope in this, that God loves them, Christ loves them. There's hope for their future, all that kind of stuff. It's all part of the deal. Yeah. And I explained usually in the beginning, like he did, that I'm here to help you. I'm not here to beat you up and knock you around. I'm here to help you walk with God and love each other better. So I guess that'd be common among all biblical counselors. Any other questions? Yeah. No, first of all, I think you can use all of this in your own personal life. Like, let's say I had, my wife's passed away, but I have a daughter, you know, so my daughter, she's not here now, but she was here yesterday. My daughter and I have a big fight. Well, I could go back to these questions, and I could say, so what happened? And what was I thinking and feeling as it was happening? And what did I do as a result? And I can focus on my own sin, and then I can say, well, what would God have wanted me to do? And how can I prepare to do it right the next time? And I would do that with any sin that I do, that I have. So we can do that for ourselves. We also can do it for each other. You guys, I was noticing in the last break that, and I noticed this at conferences in general, the longer you're in a conference, the more friendly you get with one another, right? So your friends, a ton of you are friends now, and some of you were friends before, but you're better friends now because you're going through this baptism together. I have to sit there listening to me. So you're more friends now than you were before, and you can do it with each other here. Not here, because I'm talking and you don't get to, but when we go out, you could say, can I talk to you? I'm having this struggle in my life. And you say, okay, let me get my 7 questions out. let's go through this together. Or if you have a job and you're at work or you're at school or whatever you do, and you can use all this stuff. And I really think that we started with go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. This is what all Christians should be doing all the time. It's just a different way of thinking about it, because normally we're just going through our life. This sort of spins that around a little bit and gives us a different context for all of life, which I think we need to have. We need to have it. Most of us are doing it all accidentally. It's just because God sticks us with people and we have to be disciples and make disciples. Our children, for example, we're raising children to be people who are going to live, you know, 1,000 years. We're dealing with people, little people, who are going to get older, but they're going to be around 1,000 years, and they're going to have children, and they're going to raise them, and they're going to raise them, and they're going to raise them. And it's all imitative of us. A lot of times, people have no clue that that's what's going on, and they're just happy to be here. Well, now we realize that there's more structure in the world, and God has things for us to think about all these things in a different way than we have before. So whether you actually come and sit with me and listen, watch as we do counseling, or with Marilyn or somebody else, or actually do it yourself, or never do it yourself, I'm all for all that, because the goal is to have everybody walking with God and leading people to Jesus and on to past that. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. So that's always huge in homework. Yeah. And there's, you know, knowing who Moses is or Joshua is, or knowing all that informational stuff is sort of a beginning, but knowing what Moses was teaching is a different thing. And so we're pushing on and on, raising above higher and higher. But we're all involved in that. So I think if we're all involved in that anyway, we ought to figure out what we're doing, and that's why y'all are here. So it's great. So we're good. Y'all are good. Way to go. Okay, let's take a break.